History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Napoleon once said that if the earth were a single state, Istanbul, or Constantinople in his original quote, would be its capital. Well, we have to give the general credit because he clearly knew his geography. Istanbul is the meeting point of Europe and Asia to the east and the west. It's the meeting point of the Black Sea and the Mediterranean to the north and the south. It's also the ancient convergence of the Silk Road and the Spice Road, so that's why the Ottoman Empire and Istanbul were so wealthy, because all this commerce and tariffs and merchants and everything were passing through it. And Istanbul, or Constantinople, was the pit stop for pilgrims going to Mecca or Jerusalem. So whether you were Muslim or Christian, depending on where you were coming from, you typically stopped in the city. So the point is that in the pre-modern period, any soldier, merchant, or pious person had to pass through the city. And with that much cultural interaction going on, it's no surprise that even today, Turkish food is the original fusion cuisine. Since human history, civilization, and culture converge in one place, you can make the argument that Turkish food is sort of an archaeological record of the entire human experience. So that's a little bit of a grandiose statement, but just bear with me for one second. On the far eastern side of Turkic civilization, the Uyghurs and others border China, and you have the Central Asian Turkic people who created the forefather of today's Chinese dumplings. On the far western side, you have kebabs, eggplant dishes, and other Mediterranean cuisines that many swear is actually Greek food and not Turkish. And don't get us started on the whole argument that this or that dish is actually Turkic or Turkish, but the Greeks stole it, and vice versa. Well, to sort all of this out, there's no better person on planet Earth to untangle all of this and help us understand what's going on than Derek Emai. He's a host of the YouTube channel Meet Turkey, which explores the depths of Istanbul society, culture, and food. And it's sort of a mixture of Guy Fieri's Food Network show, Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, and the travel writing of Rick Steves, all tied together with a good dose of Ottoman and Turkish history. And you can find his channel and also free cooking videos on meetturkey.io. And that's two T's in Meet Turkey, and it's M-E-E-T Turkey to be able to find that. So we discuss a lot in this episode. First of all, this is interesting tidbit, that yogurt was originally fermented horse milk made to feed the horseback-mounted warriors in Central Asia, including those in Genghis Khan's army. So this is the forefather of today's Danone or Chobani yogurt. We also discussed the fusion of Arabic and Mediterranean cuisine, which produced delights like baklava, and also head-scratching curiosities that mix sweet and savory, like one dish called chicken pudding. Trust us, the word sounds much better than the original Turkish. Finally, the strange names of Turkish dishes that translate terribly into English. One like the Sultan's Delight, the Imam Fainted, and most curiously, Women's Thigh. So Derek is a great friend. He knows a lot about all of this stuff, and I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Derek Emai. Mr. Emai, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
So your YouTube channel has received noted praise in the international media. It's been called the Thinking Man's Guy Fieri, who's the host of Food Network's Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. That Triple D meets Rick Steves, the travel writer, meets Macho Man, right? But and also meets a Macho Man Randy Savage in his prime. Now, I shouldn't mention that that quote from the international media was something I just completely made up myself. But I think would you describe your show in that way or in another way?
Well, I mean, yeah, we've obviously got the bleached tips component and the chokers that are the hallmark of Mr. I think it's actually Fieri, if you wouldn't mind pronouncing it with the proper Italian pronunciation. But yes, I mean, I would like to think, you know, it really just due to the nomenclature common to, say, your TikTok audience, you know, we're trying to really speak the language of the people while maintaining the intellectual depth and fortitude necessary to showcase some of the cuisines and cultures of one of the greatest places on earth. So, yes. And obviously, I mean, my rugged good looks and what would be the word? Daunting physique would definitely capture a macho man title, I do say.
Okay, so listeners jumping in probably think, wait, what is he talking about? All right, so to get down to it, Derek I've known very long, knows more about food than almost anyone I know, but has also lived in Istanbul for a very long time and knows Turkish society, Istanbul society very well. I've, on this show, had a couple of guests who've looked at history through the perspective of cuisine. And a lot of people can understand that. They'll know little tidbits about, oh, this little bit of American cuisine comes from this particular culture. But we also understand that a lot of what constitutes the American diet is processed food made by large corporations that basically came out after World War II. And different cultures have a whole different thing going on. And your channel gets into Turkish cuisine, but I think we should probably get into Turkish food. What is it and why is it unique?
That is a great question. And I think I almost want to caveat here with there are like wars about these kinds of things, like whose is baklava? You know what I'm saying? It's just
right.
So I'm going to go ahead and just and dive into some of the staples of Turkish cuisine with the caveat that you may say, hey, isn't that part of X, Y, or Z cuisine? Very well might be the case. But I think just as a broad spread for what is typically known in the international community as Turkish cuisine, I mean, you've got kebab, right? Kebabs in Turkish. You've got kebabs, you've got baklava, you have Turkish coffee. And I mean, I think those are some of the more well-known things. But I think the thing that I've discovered being here in Turkey is there's such a wide variety of regional cuisines. And I mean, as Scott has mentioned, kind of a depth of historical background to these things. So yeah, there's a lot more here than just the kebab, though that is definitely famous and definitely good. Also worth noting is the meat on a spit that is shaved off. You might know as gyros or shawarma. In Turkey, it's called donash. I mean, in Mexican cuisine, it's called, I'm blanking on it. Al pastor. There it is.
Yeah. The al pastor kebabs are so pathetically small compared to a doner, which like a doner is like, it's a skewer. They're turning the meat. It's like an entire cow of meat. Like how many pounds of meat is on one of those skewers? It's crazy.
Honestly,
it's
kind of, it depends on the volume of the restaurant, but I mean, there are literally some I could not wrap my arms around. You know, I mean, it was just, this is a glorious thing, but yeah, they're huge. So.
Right. I mean, it's, cause I mean, like I would read things about little historical tidbits about food where there's some Turkish food where if you know about Greek food, you think, okay, that's just it by a different name. And
totally.
Like the names of Greek food and Turkish food, it's
like spinakla, you know.
Yes. Right. Where, you know, you can see like the root word of spinach in both of them, but it's kind of the same thing. But then there's stuff that's like really not Greek. It's like, I mean, kebab restaurants in Istanbul, you've mentioned on your channel that where they have stuff from like basically near the border of Iraq or Syria. So
yeah.
Like, can you pin? Yeah, it's just like Turkish cuisine. It's not one thing, but it's this mishmash of all these different things. Are, I don't know, like restaurants that you've been to and profiled it, where they like highlight this is a certain type of food or this is a type of cuisine from this type of like village. Like, what are things that spring to your mind there?
Yeah, I mean, there's, in terms of some broader groupings, I mean, you've got like, say, restaurants from the Karadeniz or like the Black Sea region, you know, and there's some very specific dishes from the Black Sea region of Turkey. Like there's our particular breakfast dish that goes by two different names, kuymak, and can't think of the other one, mulhamam mıydı. So it's basically butter, cheese, and corn flour mixed together into this delicious paste. I mean, actually, I had it once served over the top of a piece of toasted bread with some mushrooms and dill and a poached egg. I mean, it really reminded, the taste profile was very similar to like a croque madame, if you've ever had that. I mean, it was fantastic. But I mean, that's an example. So you have Karadeniz restaurants. So you have regional ones like that. You'll have like Adana is a region of Turkey, and they have a specific kind of kebab restaurant with, they actually have a kebab named after them, Adana kebab. It's a minced meat, like ground beef kebab pressed onto a stick and then grilled over fire. You've got ev yemekleri, which is like home foods, sort of like, these are some more like traditional Turkish foods you might see served in a home. You've got those kinds of restaurants. I mean, there's just a variety of different types of restaurants with a variety of different types of foods.
And like the evolution of certain foods is really interesting. When I had a guest on who talked about like the culinary history of different foods, he said that one thing that in the 21st century, 20th century, that doesn't exist in the same way that was very common in the past is a mixture of sweet and savory.
Mm.
And this is something that when I had foreigners in Istanbul, I'd always try to bring them to and get them to eat, and they thought they were being punked, was this dessert. It's a chicken pudding. I don't know what, I forget what it's called in Turkish, but is that what it's translated to in English?
Yeah.
It's like, chicken. It's like chicken breast. And then what's put on top of it? It's not like tapioca the way we would think, but what's the stuff they put on there?
So the word muhallebi, which loosely translated into English is pudding. I mean, it's a Turkish dish that, I mean, think of pudding you could cut. I don't know if that sounds appealing to you, but almost like almost like a mochi. Do you know what I mean? With that kind of consistency. And I think some of the original ones, you know, they were made with rice flour, actually. But it's, you've got this like milk, rice flour stabilizer kind of thing with sweetness. And then from apparently the chicken influences from Arabian cuisine, right? And so they started putting shreds of chicken breast into it, which actually, I mean, I think it tastes quite good. You know, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean, being half Japanese, like the whole mochi connection thing here, you know, I think that it's very interesting, very unique. And it's, and too, those restaurants, the muhallebiciler, the places that serve those kind of puddings and or just broader milk products in general, like clotted cream and yogurt and that sort of things, sometimes they'll actually even serve chicken soup or tavuklu pilav, which is like chicken and rice, because you got to use the rest of the chicken for something, right?
Yeah.
So put the chicken breast into the pudding, which as a sentence I've never said, and then you can put the rest of the chicken into, you know, other different forms. So yeah, it's very interesting, but that muhallebi is, yeah, I really actually, I think it's fantastic. There's another version where after they make it, they kind of cook it over an open flame and it kind of toasts or burns the bottom. And they call it kazandibi, which is like bottom of the cauldron. Also a Turkish slang term for your last child. But, you know, so we have a kazandibi, let's say.
I'll have to get into that in the weird names of food, because I think one of the favorite episodes of yours that you did is that. But one more thing before we get into that.
Totally.
So muhallebi, this Turkish pudding, again, I sound like I'm a weird translation on a restaurant. So that's a pretty straightforward like Turkish dessert thing, right? And then, so from best as you understand, the chicken mixed with this pudding is kind of like this Arab-Turk fusion, if you think correctly.
Yeah, well, and I mean, and so even, yeah, to that point, the fusion, I mean, you've got to think about the history of the Turkish people, right? I mean, you've got a nomadic, I mean, the Turkic kind of ethno-linguistic swath goes all the way up into northwestern China. You know, so you have this big, broad region where the cuisine has developed from the movement of the peoples and the various geographies and their interactions with their cultures, you know. And so, I mean, so it really makes sense that you'd have, say, an Arabian influence on the cuisine. I mean, even in the Ottoman Empire, I think, like, so with muhallebi specifically and the chicken version with the influence, I mean, you know, it's, they also had a version that didn't have chicken in it. And they topped it with rose water, you know, and so you've got kind of a very similar sweet, milky flavor profile, but with a lot of like the floral side as well. So, yeah.
One of my favorite memories of, I mean, you've had this experience many times. You're bringing Americans or family members to different restaurants, and a lot of foreigners, when they first encounter Turkish food, it's almost universal praise of like, oh, this is incredible. I love it. But there's like certain cuisines where you can tell their brain can't compute what's going on. And it's like they're looking at the uncanny valley, like in movies where there's CGI that tries to look human, but it's not. And for my sister and brother-in-law, I took them to this chicken pudding restaurant and I ordered myself a big portion and I wanted to like get it for them. But I did give them the option of like choosing before they ordered. And I was just wolfing it down. And I could tell they were trying to be polite and like, oh, I think that I'll have one of those desserts instead. And because like you said, some of these places that they have other chicken savory dishes, they're smelling the chicken soup, but then it's this mixed with dessert and they can't just mix it. And oh, like speaking of brain cognitive dissonance, something that I didn't know how to compute at first, but then I grew to love from the deepest depths of my heart is Iran.
Oh, gosh.
Which,
yeah.
I mean, it's like, this is like so basic, we almost forget to mention it.
Yeah,
but,
totally. Oh, gosh.
You have one of my favorite descriptions of Iran I've heard about, like the seawater thing. So please tell us your description and then what is Iran and how it's the staple of Turkish food. But for a first timer, it's kind of true.
Well, you got to kind of, it's like yogurt mixed with seawater, right? I mean, it's, but in the best possible way, like it's really sublime. I mean, I've literally gotten to the point where I'm kind of a snob about Iron. There's actually a spectrum of Iron taste from like cottage cheesy to the other side. It's almost like milky kombucha. The superior end is the latter. However, I appreciate an Iron from anywhere on the spectrum. But yeah, I mean, yogurt is such a big part, right, of Turkish culture. And I mean, the word we use, yogurt, is from Turkish, from yormak, right, to thicken, basically. I mean, it's quintessential. And so they have developed a way to consume it faster, right? Like, you mix it with some water, you add a little salt, and you can put it back. Because I guess that idea of a savory beverage, too, that is some culinary cognitive dissonance for at least someone with an American palate. But I mean, it's fantastic. I try to get people to put it in their mind in the same place they put sour cream. Like, you're eating, like, this rich, spicy, like, meaty, savory dish. You want to cut it with, like, something a little bit... You know, it has that kind of creaminess, but also kind of tanginess. That's Iron. It's just your beverage. It's not a topping. And if they can like do the kind of mental gymnastics to put it in that way, I think that people end up really liking it, I think, eventually.
Oh, yeah. I mean, after a while, like you crave one after eating a rich dish to polish it off.
Absolutely.
With one.
Yeah.
But yeah, foreigners, or you're showing people around the city the first time they come, they... It hurts you. It just hurts your soul a little bit when they don't want it. You feel like someone called your kid ugly when they're rejecting Iron or kefir or kefir. Yeah. Listeners, kefir is another thing that is much more common. But yeah, coming back to totally. America, we call it kefir. But oh, you mean kefir? It's like, yeah, if you want to say it wrong, sure, kefir.
Oh my god,
if you want to be wrong. Okay, so one thing I stuck a hole in later, but the goofy names of Turkish food that when you translate it to English just sounds super, super weird. And listeners, check out Derek's episode on this particular topic because it's hilarious. Mostly, if you go to the touristy parts of Istanbul, you'll have one of the best things is you get a menu. It's translated to English. It's translated terribly. It sounds like by a man in his 40s who looked up literally on Google Translate what it is. And you see the names of it and like, what is this? So please tell me some of these things because this is a great episode.
So I'm gonna combine this into actually two categories. So in Turkish, the word for rotisserie chicken is pilis çevirme. Çevirme also means translate, can be translated as translate, not just rotisserie. So there has been a rotisserie chicken on the menu as chicken translate. So this is very meta. I really appreciate the Turks for doing this. So anytime something is poorly translated on a menu, they call it a chicken translate. You know, oh, this must be another chicken translate. For example, there's this Turkish dish where it's kind of like a salsa. It's chopped up tomatoes and peppers and onions. You know, it's tangy, sweet, and a little spicy. And it's called acizmesi. I have definitely seen that on a menu as crushing pain, which is a severe overestimation of actually how spicy it is. But there's another good one where I guess, you know, when you, on the door, it says push to open, right? And in Turkish, it's actually a command, like itiniz, like it's saying you push the door, which has been translated your dog is also a translation to that. So, I mean, so there are all these chicken translates, but there really are Turkish foods that, when translated correctly, still have a crazy name. So there's an eggplant dish in particular called the Imam Fainted. I mean, I guess legend has it, he liked it so much that he passed out, you know. And actually, in Turkish, saying that you fainted is a way to express your admiration for something. Similar to that, there's another dish with eggplant as the base called Hünkar Beğendi, which means the Sultan liked it. It's like, wow, that must have been so quintessential. I can't imagine being like, hey, what are we having for dinner? Oh, the Sultan liked it, or the president liked it. That's what we're having for dinner. It's just such a weird... But I mean, for me, like the quintessential one is Kadın Büdü Köftesi, which is translated as... Scott, would you like to do the honors?
Women's thighs.
Women's thighs meatballs. Such a weird... I mean, there's other things too, like... Have you ever had gavurda salatası?
It's quite I don't good. Think I have, but I'm really but looking name... forward to where this the explanation is.
Well, I mean, what? How would you translate gavurda into English? Gavurda.
The infidels.
Mountain.
I don't know.
it's just there's just, but it's a kind of salad, a very good one, I might add. And Lastly,
that's
I
don't know if that came from like a military campaign into the Balkans or where they were fighting some Christian kingdom. That's my guess, but who knows? Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Yeah, seriously. The last one though, which is also food with a weird name and mainly a chicken translate, is Ichli Kofte. Ichli Kofte is fantastic. I mean, if you can imagine a corn dog, but like stuffed with ground meat and pine nuts instead of a hot dog, no stick either, but Ichli Kofte, but you can translate that as sensitive meatball, which is, Ichli actually means like stuff, but sensitive meatball, I think that might be, I don't know. There's a lot of good ones for sure.
Yeah, I think for listeners who are totally confused, I think there's so many things where it sounds so much better in the native language. And
totally.
I mean, we're Turkish is itself. How do we say this? There's when you were asking the host in this episode of Weird Translations, and when you said, okay, women's thigh, what is this? And she was trying to strain her brain of how does this make sense? And Turkish is there's a romantic aura that can be expressed in so many words, and a poeticness, also a sexualness that can come across too. Also lots of double entendres. Profanity in Turkish exists at a level that English can't even possibly approach. And this is a family friendly podcast, but I think in an honor shame culture, you have to have powerful weapons to take down your opponent. So profanity is, takes it to the next level in Turkish. I'm getting almost misty eyed just thinking about it. So many memories and yeah.
Yes, I remember asking my children early on, because they go to a Turkish school. I said, tell me every bad word that you know, right? Küfür is like that. I was like, tell me every küfür you know. So they were telling me all these words, and I'm saying, do you know that word in English? They're like, what does that mean in English? They're like, well, it means like but in a bad way. You know, and I'm like, oh, so you don't even know the English equivalent for this word, but you know, you're in first or third grade and you're educated. You know, you speak the local language. So
I mean, people who are otherwise very conservative would say things that when translated is pretty raunchy in English, but it's because there's only like gentleman's profanity, which is down here. Mm-hmm. And then like versus like the most vile thing you could say is two steps beyond the worst thing we could say. So
Yeah, I
don't know. I hope listeners, you might be wondering, what were they talking about? It's to communicate the wretchedness of the Turkish language. That's just hard to get across. But one thing you mentioned, the imam fainted and Hünkar Bandi. I really love it that they're very eggplant based, which we don't have a lot of that in America. But when you really know how to use an eggplant, think of it as a vacuum cleaner for olive oil. Man, how much olive oil can you put in one eggplant, like a liter? It just keeps, the saturation point is something else. It just takes and takes and takes. And
oh, absolutely. I mean, the way the eggplant is used in cuisine, I mean, it is really fantastic. Like roasted, I mean, the Hünkar Bandi, for example, the dish that we mentioned. I mean, you basically roast an eggplant on open coals, which if you're going to try this at home, please poke holes in your eggplant first so it doesn't explode in your face. You roast the eggplant close to a heat source. You peel it, you chop it up, you make a nice little roux out of butter and flour, add some milk, throw in the pureed eggplant and some cheese. And then on top of it, you put cubed lamb or beef that's cooked in like a tomato sauce with green peppers. I mean, I can see why the Sultan liked it. It's pretty fantastic.
Yeah. So this is just kind of like shifting gears. I'm curious, like in Turkish cuisine, there's claims that this or that dish originates from, let's say, the Sultan's kitchen, Hünkar Bandi.
Totally.
The Sultan enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
And any cuisine, French cuisine, Italian cuisine, has sort of a high cuisine, something that you would have as a five-course dinner versus this is the cheap food that a worker would just eat on a pinch. And it's a loaf of bread with some whatever stuff thrown in it. So do you know much based on food that would be at the Sultan's court? And then before we started recording, you also mentioned things that were influenced by saints or pilgrims or Rumi, religious mystics. What are some of these cuisines that came out of different places, whether Sultan's court or elsewhere?
So, I mean, it's interesting even looking at Turkish society today where, I mean, food is just taken very seriously at every kind of socioeconomic level, you know? And so I think when you look back at the history of Turkish cuisine, I mean, so in the Ottoman palaces, you know, people would eat off of a, is it sini? The big, like, silver tray, right? It would come, be put on the ground, people would sit around it, you would eat with your hands or with a spoon, and you would just eat a little bit, you know? And so you had those kinds of maybe some big, elaborate meals. But a lot of the foods that I read about from Ottoman times, I mean, in 1923, with the foundation of the Turkish Republic, apparently Turkish food was divided into two major categories: your classic Turkish dishes and then your regional Turkish dishes, right? And classical Turkish dishes would have basically been kind of a carryover from the Ottoman era, maybe kind of the palace foods kinds of thing, whereas regional dishes more reflected the various geographies and cultural backgrounds of people across the land. So I think that there's a sense in which there's a lot of continuity, both through the ages and potentially even through the social classes of different types of food. Now meat, for example, is, you know, is even today and to a degree is, I mean, that's, it's almost like more of a seasoning in certain parts of Turkish food rather than the main dish. I mean, that really depends, I think, on what part of the country. And if you're more in like the Gaziantep area, I mean, it's very meat heavy, you know, but I mean, even the use of meat in dishes varies from region to region. So yeah, so there's, you know, I think a lot of continuity on that level. But yeah, you mentioned the Rumi thing. I mean, so that's something, I don't know how familiar people are with Turkey and like Sufism, but, you know, Konya, a city in Turkey, is kind of like the place that you go, you know, for Mevlana or Rumi. And apparently, you know, there's a rich food tradition coming from Sufism that even endures today in Konya. I was looking through some of the recipes, and I mean, it seems like pretty, you know, recognizable stuff. It doesn't seem way out there. Like there was a pilaf dish made with bulgur, which is cracked wheat, and, you know, chestnuts and stuff. So it's very recognizable stuff to kind of the modern Turkish sensibility, but apparently has its roots back from Rumi. I mean, apparently it was so important that one of his chefs, Atish Baz, which, what does the Baz suffix mean? It's like, do you remember?
Yeah, I'm blanking.
Atish Baz is like player, someone who like plays with something. Yeah. So when I read Atish Baz, I'm thinking like firebender, you know? So, but so the guy's name was Atish Baz, and he's the only, I guess, chef who's ever gotten, been like, what's the word? Turbe. What is that? Like entombed, like in a mausoleum.
Canonized, sort of, in
1285, apparently, around there. Like, and so even, I guess, people wanting to enter the tarikat, right? Like the place of learning, if you wanted to become
the
kind
dojo,
of a,
one could the, say.
the Sufi dojo, apparently.
Any Turkish listener is just shaking their head now.
Yeah, kusura bakmayı. But there apparently you would start your training in the kitchen. You would sit on this like pole for 3 days and just watch the different people serving and doing their different things. And after that, if you wanted to stay, you started your lessons and your tests in the kitchen, right? And so, I mean, I think this really highlights even like historically and religiously some of the importance of food in one of the traditions of, you know, faith expressions that you find still in Turkey today. So, really interesting stuff.
Yeah, and one, I used to read a lot about this, and I've forgotten most of it, just kind of like the culinary history of cuisine. One thing I think I remember is my professor, when I was doing my master's, he was a German gentleman named Christoph Neumann, who is a very eccentric fellow. He had the facial hair of like a 17th century German diplomat. I mean, it's sideburns, but they went down about 8 or 10 inches. It was, I have no category for him, but he was a very accomplished chef, and he had studied the history of Ottoman cuisine. I think one thing he mentioned is that with spices, Turkish or Ottoman cuisine, whatever you want to call it, used to have things like saffron. So a lot more saffron, a lot more cinnamon, partly due to the fact that Istanbul itself was on the terminus of, it was a route for the Silk Road and then also a route for the Spice Road. So part of the reason the Ottoman Empire accrued so much wealth in its early stages in the 1400s and 1500s is before the Age of Discovery really kicked in hard. If Europeans wanted luxury goods, which were mostly spices and things, much of it traded hands through the Ottoman Empire from India, China, through different caravan routes, through the Ottoman Empire, and then through Europe to the Mediterranean ports, and then on to the rest of Europe. So much of that would pass hands through there, and then these very expensive spices were put on foods. And I went to a restaurant. It was a Turkmen restaurant from the nation of Turkmenistan, and they had this chicken that they put saffron on. It was awesome. It was Like American cuisine, we don't really put saffron on much of anything. It's crazy expensive here. So that's probably reason. I think, is saffron, is it cheaper over there? Or maybe like, or is it crazy expensive there too?
No, I mean, it's interesting because saffron, when you buy it here, the good stuff is, Iranian saffron. You know, I mean, I think there's kind of a Turkish saffron, but I wonder if that is a little more like turmeric, where it's there for the color more than the taste kind of thing, you know? It's I actually think that, I mean, saffron is one of those things that I haven't really run into almost anywhere here. I mean, you have it in paella, right? Like if you're having like Spanish cuisine. I mean, that has been my primary like reference point for his application. But I don't know if I've ever seen it in a restaurant here, actually, in contemporary Turkish cuisine.
Yeah, so I think they've really... They've taken the best from different places, so have shed its Central Asian roots, which Central Asians, I love you, but man, your horse milk, I could not wrap my taste buds around that, or the horse meat in the horse milk.
Scott, horse milk.
Or am I miss?
Fermented horse milk is the precursor to Iron. I mean, you got to remember where you came from. So, I mean, So yogurt, right? I mean, people, when you think about the history of yogurt, like people will say it's probably started around 5000 BC, about the time where animals were being domesticated.
Right.
You know, apparently around 2000 BC, as people were storing like milk in like, you know, animal intestines or stomachs or whatever, you're getting the bacteria and the heat and you're starting to get yogurt. But, you know, fast forward a lot, Genghis Khan apparently fed his army with yogurt / fermented horse milk, right? So still there, and potentially this kind of precursor to our modern day much loved ayran.
And yeah, like you said earlier, I think one of the few, if perhaps only, words in the English language that comes from Turkish is yogurt. And so if you're having your low calorie Danone yogurt that you're having after your hot yoga session, keep in mind that it originated was fermented horse milk that fed the armies of Genghis Khan as they were going through the Khwarezmian Empire, plundering and destroying and leveling total villages. So from that, feeding and nourishing a horseback mounted archer who's taking out villagers, to the everyone after the hot yoga session enjoying the after class snack with their activated microbial yogurt. There it is.
And so, in addition to that, if after your hot yoga session and you're in New York City and you headed over to, say, Kotz's Deli for a pastrami sandwich, you will also be eating a dish that the the same kind of army would have produced. Because apparently, as far back as, like, you know, so pastirma, right? It sounds a little even like pastrami, which I think that, you know, the etymological origins are there. But, I mean, as apparently, that comes from, there's some arguments over where the word comes from, but the Turkish term bastırma, to press, so apparently pastırma, which it's a cured meat, kind of like bresaola, the Italian bresaola, it was cured and it was placed under the saddle. So, and they would ride on it, it would be pressing it down. There's also apparently accounts of being pressed under or between the legs. Apparently, Ammianus Marcellinus wrote about it in his time with the Huns using this meat. But apparently, your chobani and your pastrami sandwich would have gotten you through a lot of conquest. So it's got these roots way, way back. Fun fact on chobani, it's called Greek yogurt, but it was started by a Turkish guy who missed Turkish yogurt and thought, I need to bring Turkish yogurt to America. And for some reason thought, no one's going to buy Turkish yogurt. I'm going to call it Greek yogurt. But I mean, Choban is shepherd in, you know, Turkish. So it's, this is where it comes from.
Right. And like Greeks will always claim, oh, this food, Turks claim it's theirs. It's actually ours. Turks will do the same. And it's very, very, very similar, all mixed around. And another thing you mentioned with things that would go back to a glorious warrior martial culture past that has now been distilled into, you know, sandwiches at a deli and hot yoga. I think I saw a coiffure. Coiffure is hair salon. And a lot of times in places in Istanbul, the name of the owners, it will be on the establishment. It was hair salon owned by Genghis and Attila, Chinggis and Attila. So Attila the Hun, Chinggis, a somewhat common name in Turkey, which is Genghis. So I wonder what the horseback mounted archers would think as they're looking to what has come about now. It's
totally.
And, you know, We're almost like you mentioned that story, and I've heard a lot of things. We're kind of entering the realm of Turkish nationalism, where people will claim everything of everyone else's history as theirs. That mm-hmm. Atatürk loved doing this. I think he claimed that the Irish were actually Turks because the suffix IR is a suffix in the Turkish language, and super nationalistic Turkish history, which isn't even taught in Turkey anymore in the 30s and 40s, is, oh, the Hittites, they were actually Turks. The Sumerians, they were actually Turks. Any great civilization, it was actually the Turks, and then they did a costume change and became the Greeks, and they did another costume change, became Romans, and, oh, these Native American languages in Cherokee, here's a few words that sound like words in Turkish. That's actually, you know, they're speaking Turkish, so everything comes back from here, and it, so we have plenty of, like, Turkish nationalist theories. Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Well, and on that too, with the idea, I think two of the most hotly contested, like, culinary things here are going to be Turkish coffee, which is anathema to some people just by its name, and baklava. Right? Those are the things where it's like, oh man, this is ours. And people from all over the region, is it Turkish coffee, Greek coffee, Arab coffee, Arabic coffee? You know, there's all these different things. And so just Turkish coffee, interestingly enough, apparently coffee doesn't come from Turkey, by the way. Turkish coffee, I think, can potentially be a misnomer in like, oh, this is really good coffee from Turkey. Turkish coffee is actually a preparation technique. It's not actually like the source of the coffee, right? So historically, I mean, coffee came from Yemen, apparently, back in the 16th century to Turkey from Yemen. And the idea of Turkish coffee is the preparation technique is you grind the coffee super fine. I mean, finer than espresso. You would grind it for espresso and you brew it in a little pot called an ibrik or a cezve. And when you dump it out, so if you want sugar in it, you actually put it in it while it's brewing. And then you dump it into a little cup, grounds and all. So what you never want to do if you're served Turkish coffee is to immediately take it and start drinking it, because you need to let the grounds settle, number one. And as you get close to the bottom, just be careful, be delicate, or you get a mouthful of sand, basically. You know, it's but I mean, it's Turkish coffee, I think it's great. There's a lot of culture and customs surrounding it. I mean, people use the grounds for fortune telling after you drink it. You know, that's a traditional thing. Apparently, so in Turkish society, you know, when to an American audience, if you say like proposal, engagement, it's down on one knee at a restaurant with a ring, right? You know, here when you talk about proposal, it's both families sitting across from each other in a house, you know, going through this ceremony. And so I guess historically, especially before you would really, the bride and groom would meet before the proposal ceremony, if they came together and saw each other for the first time and the bride was like, yeah, this isn't going to work for me. You know, she has to make everybody Turkish coffee and she throws salt into the groom's coffee as a way to be like, pack up your parents and go home. This isn't going to work, buddy. You know, so it's kind of a, you know, a little soft power, like signal there kind of thing. So, you know, it's definitely, you know, coffee. I mean, coffee is so fundamental that the word for breakfast in Turkish is named after coffee, right? Kahvaltı. So,
before coffee. Yeah. I mean, I think the little cups there, it's a totally different experience. And there's a funny apocryphal story that the reason coffee exists in the West is because of Turks, because in the second siege of Vienna in 1683, the Polish army came from the north and the Ottomans were flanked and caught completely unawares. So they had to abandon their camp and flee, and left in their back camp were sacks of coffee. This made its way into the city of Vienna, which established coffee shops. Now, that's not true, listeners, because it's not like the Ottoman Empire only had war with Europe. Obviously, there was also a robust trade relationship. So coffee was being traded to Europe. There were coffee shops in England well before the Siege of Vienna in the 1600s. And then when coffee takes place in America, that's mostly coming from the Caribbean and those plantations instead of the Ottoman Empire. But it's a great story. So that's why things stick, because of fun stories like that. And yeah, I mean, Turkey is getting a lot more filtre kahvesi, the filtered coffee, like we would have in America, but is not, but in tea and, yeah, there are these things that are so fundamental, we don't even think to mention them. Tea in Turkey is omnipresent. There is no word that manages like tea in Turkey. Sometimes they're probably drinking like 20 cups a day in these tulip-shaped glasses. Sometimes you just turn around and then you look back and there's a cup of tea in my hand. Where did this come from? This is like, I don't know. Can you articulate the omnipresence of chai or tea in, they call it chai. It's not chai. Like, don't think of our chai tea in America, but just like, where does that come from? Or just like,
I mean, it really is everywhere. And the sound, so you typically, tea comes in like in a little tulip shaped glass, it probably holds like, 3 ounces maybe? It's a pretty small glass. And it's usually served with 1 or 2 sugar cubes on the side. I actually don't put sugar in my tea because I don't just want to eat sugar all day, basically.
No, which is,
it's really funny because when I sometimes, I can distinctly remember moments where I'm like, oh, I don't. Even the way you say it in Turkish, like, I don't use sugar. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, I don't smoke kind of thing, you know, like, and people are like, wow, you're so healthy. I'm like, because I don't want like 10 sugar cubes a day. Anyway, but the sound though of stirring the sugar cube into the tea with a little spoon, that little, you know, tinkling noise, I feel like that's one of the hallmarks of just a sound that you hear in Turkey everywhere. You know, I mean, it's definitely, it's funny because Turkey is known for Turkish coffee, but it is definitely a tea culture. I mean, overall. So,
yeah, I think per capita it has the highest tea consumption of anywhere in the world. It's almost, it would have been easy to forget mentioning it because it's like a fish mentioning water, where it's so much of life. But if you were the first time you would come there, you notice that everyone is drinking from these little tulip cups. If you have any kind of meeting, there's someone there who's bringing chai to you.
And I mean, for a tip too, if you hopefully will travel to Turkey and experience this for yourself, the way they prepare tea in Turkey is they prepare tea as like a concentrate in one kettle, and then there's hot water. So when you serve yourself tea, you pour a little bit of the concentrate, say, you know, 25% of your glass, and then you fill the rest with water to dilute it. So I definitely have seen, you know, tourists visiting Istanbul, and they'll come in and they'll just fill their entire cup with the concentrate, you know? So when you come, it's also, this is just a great place to ask somebody to prepare for you, because usually people are very accommodating, but... Yeah,
there's a double pot where there's the main just hot water on one and the concentrate on top. And then the pot on the bottom is open so that the steam rises to the top. I made that mistake absolutely the first time I was there of just doing the concentrate. And the right color consistency, do they call it rabbit's blood? Is that a common thing, or is that when just me being weird?
When it like looks, I mean, yeah, sometimes, you know, I don't know if it's with a certain type of leaf or whatever, but it almost will take on like a, what's the word? Like a red color, and they'll call that, that's good, like rabbit's blood tea. So, yeah.
Again, listeners, like, it sounds better in Turkish, so just bear with us. If you saw it on a menu, you'd think, what is going on here? What is, so the other thing I can mention, so your channel, I mean, a lot of it is profiling specific restaurants, and a lot of it is they'll prepare things in a really unique way. So this was the Guy Fieri Diners.
Totally.
Drive-ins and dives. I always get that mixed up. Element I mix where he's profiling really interesting places. And were there any that came to mind from your show, or they do things due to this interesting historical quirk? Because every restaurant in Istanbul claims itself as being historical and or famous. It's always famous or historical.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting. So thinking about that, so even the things available in a lot of these restaurants, like some of the fundamental ingredients they used, I mean, you think about like kebab even. I mean, kebab was almost necessitated by a nomadic culture, right? Like that's how you cook things, right? From that kind of setting, you know? And so you've got the, you know, how do I do, just even thinking of cooking methods like kebab, it's like, how do I cook meat out here when I'm traveling around? Well, you put it on a spit and you cook it over the fire, right? Or even preservation techniques, right? I mean, it's interesting how much of like fundamental foodstuffs come from the necessity of having to preserve things without refrigeration, right? So, and in Turkish cuisine, or in Turkish, cuisine, let's say, there's a lot of even communal preparation things, right? So you need to preserve it, but it's not like you yourself are going to preserve it. You as the village come together with the harvest and make, say, molasses. Molasses is a really big deal in Turkey. You know, in America, you've got the cereal aisles with like 1,200 kinds of cereals. And in Turkey, you've got shelves of molasses, right? You've got grape molasses and carob molasses and mulberry molasses. And there's all these different, and because part of it is from the history where, you know, that was one way that you use fruit, right? You prepared it into molasses, or you have tomato paste, or you have pepper paste, or there's a rather interesting thing called tarhana in Turkey, where it was, okay, well, we can dry out meat, you know, and make sausage or pastirma or whatnot, but what do we do with milk? Okay, we can make it into yogurt, but that still doesn't last very long. So they'd take the yogurt, some tomatoes, you know, some mint, Stuff like that. And now even they use like, I think like chickpeas. You can put all kinds of stuff into it. Onions. And you kind of mash it all up and you spread it out and let it dry. And it turns into the, like this powder. And they take that powder and it's almost like instant soup. Right? So this is like the original from years and years and years ago, probably dating back to Central Asian, you know, Turkey. It's like, this is the original instant soup. And, you know, they put it into, you know, whatever kind of liquid they have, you know, beef broth or some kind of broth or hot water or something. You know, and so it's interesting to see, you know, the historical development of modern Turkish food being necessitated by their limitations on both preparation and preservation.
They spin gold out of yarn, though.
It's incredible.
Yeah. So something that's confused me in this discussion is we're talking about cuisine that's influenced by a Central Asian nomadic past and due to the Turkish people migrating west over several centuries. That's one element where there's this Eastern thing. But then there's this whole Mediterranean element where it comes from the West. And I can't wrap my, I mean, what's going on? There are these two, but
yeah,
how can they work?
It's interesting. When you think about like the geography of Istanbul, you have the Bosphorus Strait that cuts right through the city, which makes half of the city in Asia and half of the city in Europe. I mean, really geographically, it's like, man, how could you describe it? It's sort of like the point at which East meets West.
Wait.
Let me say that again for your listeners. That's important enough to repeat. This is like the point where East meets West.
Wait, wow. But it has to be all East. You know, it has to be completely culturally Eastern. But then it has to be completely culturally Western, and they're walled off. I mean, how would they meet? What?
I think I'm breaking your brain here, man, but it's really East. Let me say, this is where East meets West. Like,
so wait. So it's the bridge. It's like a connection. They're meeting.
Yeah.
And there's actually bridges in Istanbul too
that
connect them. What?
This is like the bridge.
So it's like they're a metaphor. Oh, so it's a, oh, okay.
Oh,
whoa. Double rainbow across the sky. So for listeners, obviously Derek and I are doing a bit. I think it's sort of, when you read guidebooks or anything, the Turkish Ministry of Culture, one of the very, very first go-to lines is Turkey is a bridge between civilizations where East meets West. And it's just, what are other cliches like that? Bridge between civilizations.
My favorite is juxtaposition. It's like there's so much juxtaposed here. You wouldn't believe the juxtaposition you see in the city between old and new, modern and traditional, religious and secular, and East and West. And it's like juxtaposition.
Like one I heard was where there was a mosque and next to it was a cell phone store with a tower. And someone says, oh, look at that. It's traditional religious and it's modern. And I think, well, I mean, like, what do you expect that their city zoning ordinance requires that no modern technology can be between like 500 feet of a mosque? I mean, like, what do you expect?
It definitely is overplayed, but that concept actually, you know, do you know who David Chang is, by the way? David Chang is like,
I do.
He's a restaurateur, chef, kind of, you know, he's one of the patron saints of like hipster foodieism. You know what I mean? Like, you could probably say. And I think that, you know, he basically has said like Istanbul or Turkish food is like one of the most underrated cuisines. And like Istanbul itself is kind of like the, you know, he said OG, the OG of fusion. Do you know what I mean? It's like, this is the place where the idea of fusion began. You know, that's like a hip thing in culinary things now. It's like, oh, this is fusion food. It's like, that's just Turkish food history is fusion, you know? And so, yeah, I am all about people experiencing, you know, that fusion, that meeting of East meets West kind of thing. You know, it definitely, I mean, because you think about, so, you know, in northwestern China, you have the Uyghur people, which, you know, you can look them up online. And you should. But, you know, it's their food, like Laman, is kind of like Chinese lo mein, you know, and all the way down, like okay, so the like pot sticker, like dumplings, right? I mean, Turkey has manta, which are like these little tiny meat-filled dumplings, typically served with garlic yogurt and kind of a browned butter, you know, red chili sauce on top. Fantastic. You should try it. But I mean, that is a distant relative, well, you know, cousin of like the pot sticker, the shumai, the bao. Do you know what I mean? It's you've got kind of the, what's the word? As it's kind of come west and south a bit, you it's changed and it's become kind of what it is now. And I think, you know, it's almost like here you're eating, you know, the product of the progression of history, the movement of geography, you know, the taking on of different cultures and societies. I mean, it's really like you're finding all these things coming together into the plate of food that you eat here. And I think the rich history, you know, of the Turkish people, you really get it presented to you on a plate here, and you can really interact with it in a very visceral kind of way. I think it's, anyway, that's why I love it. So.
Yeah. I mean, there are endless things we could say about this, that a lot of Turkish food would be recognizable to somebody who likes Greek food because it's very mixed in. But like you said, there's this proto pot sticker, and a lot of noodles and things like that didn't even make their way to Europe until the Middle Ages, but it was there in the Ottoman Empire much before, amongst the Turkish people, even before they migrated west. So that is why, like I mentioned in the prologue to this episode, check out Derek's channel, because there's a lot of stuff on YouTube food channels, and some of it is good. Some of it is some hipster stumbling to Istanbul, like, oh, you will never believe what I discovered. And they're basically on the equivalent of Times Square, and they're eating a slice of Sbarro pizza. Like, that's the equivalent of what they're doing with Turkish food, that they're going to the most well-known restaurant, but, like, you would know what's like, oh, it's just, like, garbage, like, stuff that you shovel into your mouth. But Derek knows all the hidden gems of the city, so don't watch these other people's channel, watch his channel. Any other, if people want to find you on the internet, on Friendster or MySpace or other channels, or there's other ones too, but I'm not really caught up on the latest channels. Where's the best place for people to find you online?
MySpace is a little new for me. But yeah, so actually, I mean, we've definitely done some YouTube stuff. I think we're trying to branch out channel-wise. So, but the one-stop shop for everything is, if you go to our website, it's meetturkey.io. And don't forget to put two T's. For some reason, it's really easy to pay me turkey. So it's meet to, like, please to meet you, not like beef, you know. So meetturkey.io, if you go there, actually the episode you mentioned with the funny food names or whatever, that's on the front page of it too. You can find it there. And we're actually, you know, going to be start coming out with, you know, I've talked up a lot about Turkish food, and you're thinking, well, I'm, especially these days, I'm stuck at home, how wonderful. We're going to start putting out some content on how to actually make Turkish food at home, say in America, using ingredients you can typically find there. So if you are interested in that, head over to the site and you can sign up, and we can keep you updated with that. But yeah, that's coming.
Check that out, because Derek knows his stuff. So Mr. Emai, thank you much for joining us and illuminating us with your knowledge.
Thanks for having me. That was great.
All right. That is all for today's episode. As a first order of business, I need to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and I'll explain what that is in a second. And they are Kristen Lee, Willie from New Jersey, Sumo 41, Sergeant Hooch, Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com, Bill Ivey, Tom from Ohio, Salvador Sanchez, Dane Carlson from Linwood, Washington, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael Piccinetti, Michael from New York, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Josh Reddick, Jake Harrington, Josh from BFW Post 2285, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. Now, if you'd like to support History Unplugged and help it grow, there are three easy ways to do so. First, subscribe to the show and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people discover the show. Second, join our Facebook group, and here you can discuss recent episodes with fellow listeners, mention what you'd like to see on the show in the future, and get way more out of the show, and just look for History Unplugged on Facebook. Third, become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army established by George Washington, but it's also the membership group of History Unplugged, and here you can really dive in way deeper with the show. You can check it out by going to Patreon, patreon.com/unplugged. If you join at the Scout level, you get early access to new podcast episodes, and you get completely ad-free versions of the entire back catalog of more than 500 episodes. Plus, everything is neatly categorized, so if you want to listen to something about the Middle Ages and skip all the Civil War stuff or vice versa, you can easily find an old episode from 3 years ago that, if you're just looking on Apple Podcasts, would be buried in the feed. If you join the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff, but access to a growing catalog of now more than 60 premium episodes that come out bi-weekly, including a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, a series on French Foreign Legion fighters in World War I, one on Teddy Roosevelt's years in the Dakota Badlands, and a series on Nazi attempts to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Lastly, if you join the Spymaster level, you get all the same stuff as level 1 and 2, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode.
You can choose a historical topic on absolutely anything, and I'll base an hour-long episode on it. Plus, you get a 3-pack of hardcover books. So again, check it all out by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Well, that's all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.